This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton. The death toll and devastating flooding in western Germany and Belgium rose to at least 168 on Saturday after burst rivers and flash floods this week collapsed houses and ripped up roads and power lines. Some 141 people died in the flooding in Germany's worst natural disaster in more than half a century. That included about 98 in the Ahrweiler district south of Cologne, according to police. German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier visited Erfstadt in the state of North Rhine-Westphalia, where the disaster killed at least 43 people. Around 700 residents were evacuated late on Friday after a dam broke in the town of Wassenberg near Cologne, authorities said, but the Wassenberg mayor said water levels had been stabilizing since the night. The Steinbachtal Dam in western Germany, however, remained at risk of breaching after some 4,500 people were evacuated from homes downstream. Steinmeier said it would take weeks before the full damage could be assessed. It's expected to require several billions of euros in reconstruction funds. In Belgium, the death toll rose to 27, according to the National Crisis Center, which is coordinating the relief operation there. It added that 103 people were missing or unreachable. In the southern Belgian provinces of Luxembourg and Namur, authorities rushed to supply drinking water to households without a clean water supply. Water levels slowly fell in the worst-hit parts of Belgium. Prime Minister Alexander De Croo and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen visited some areas on Saturday afternoon. You can keep up on that story on the flooding at our website, voanews.com. We also have a mobile app that you can download. This is VOA News. There's worry that Tokyo's Olympics could become a super spreader event after an unidentified person inside the Olympic Village tested positive for the coronavirus. Person is reportedly not an athlete, but someone from abroad helping to organize the games. The case is one of 15 new positive results among games participants and workers reported on Saturday, according to Kyoto News Service. Kyoto says there have been a total of 45 COVID-19 infections announced by organizers since July 1st. Gunmen abducted at least 60 people in northwestern Nigeria after riding motorbikes into five villages and firing sporadically into the air, this according to a police official. Nigeria is battling an increase in armed robberies and kidnappings for ransom, mainly in northwestern areas where thinly stretched security forces often fail to stop the abductions. The latest kidnapping took place in Zamfara State overnight on Friday. That's according to a regional police spokesman who added that investigations are ongoing. Four residents told Reuters news agency that armed men had attacked villages in the Shinkafi area, causing panic and abducting at least 60 villagers before escaping into the nearby forest. South African authorities in the port city of Durban said Saturday they were investigating a coastal chemical spill that may have been caused by a warehouse fire during unrest this week. Investigators are also looking at other possibilities for the cause of the spill, which is affecting marine and bird life. Locals have been urged not to use beaches in the area. The head of the Environmental Affairs in KwaZulu-Natal province said water samples will be tested on Monday. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said on Friday the unrest that has ripped through South Africa in the past week is stabilizing and calm has been restored to most of the affected areas, but the destruction will cost the country billions of rand. Ramaphosa was addressing the nation over the rioting that broke out in several parts of the country last week after his predecessor, Jacob Zuma, was jailed for failing to appear at a corruption inquiry. The police have arrested over 2,500 people suspected to be involved in inciting violence. The president said these cases are being prioritized. And Afghanistan said Saturday the daughter of its ambassador to neighboring Pakistan was briefly abducted and tortured by unknown assailants. A foreign ministry statement issued in Kabul condemned the incident, saying the woman was on her way home in the Pakistani capital of Islamabad when she was taken captive for several hours by unknown individuals. The statement said the woman is in a local hospital and Pakistani authorities are investigating. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton. This is VOA News. We'll be right back.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
We support this group that is filing for the fundamental enforcement, you know, for the rights of those who have been unlawfully detained by the DSS. The DSS has no locus in this matter. And that's why we support those who have filed the action.
A Nigerian civil society group demands the immediate and unconditional release of all protesters.
The ongoing crisis all over Cameroon is too much on women, and women as a majority of the population shall be mobilized to take up their responsibilities and remind the powers that be that enough is enough.
Cameroonian women peace activists plan to soon meet to find solutions to the ongoing conflict in the Anglophone parts of the country.
This is a time bomb because these other people will still come back to the hospital as emergencies. So what is best is not to hold them for now, but to employ more healthcare workers so that these people can still continue going for those outpatient departments.
And Zambian Resident Doctors Association calls for international help for personal protective equipment to help fight a surge in coronavirus cases. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law, a political pressure group, is calling on the government to immediately release five protesters detained by the Department of State Services. The protesters, wearing Buhari Must Go t-shirts, were arrested during a religious service at Dunamis International Gospel Center, a popular church in the capital Abuja. But the rights group says the arrest by the Secret Service is illegal and an affront to the Constitution. This after lawyers for the detained protesters challenged their arrest in court, contending that their fundamental rights have been violated. They are also seeking for about $24,390 each for what they say is their continuous and unlawful detention. Deji Adeyanju is the convener for Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law. He tells me that the government must release the protesters immediately without preconditions. He also adds it is unacceptable for the government to criminalize protests, which he says are protected by the Constitution.
Today is day six since the five Abuja protesters, Buhari Must Go t-shirt wearing protesters, were arrested at the Dunamis Church in Abuja. And the update is that they have not been released. They are still in DSS custody. To the best of my knowledge, a lot of effort has been made, especially by the church, you know, to prevail on the Nigerian Secret Police, the DSS, to release these protesters, and with no luck. I have been in touch with the presiding pastor of the Dunamis Church, and in fact, on many occasions, he has put me on the phone while he made several calls to the SSS, you know, urging and asking for their release. But we do not know why the SSS have suddenly criminalized protests. But under the President Muhammadu Buhari regime, protest has almost become a crime in the country.
But Deji, some Nigerians are saying that what these five gentlemen did by going into the church wearing Buhari Must Go t-shirt was a publicity stunt planned by critics of the president just to score cheap political points and tarnish the government as well as the church. How do you respond to that?
See, the government has no image that anyone can tarnish. This government has already destroyed its own credibility, and it has exhausted the credibility limit of its regime. And anyhow you look at it, you know, he who has no reputation cannot complain of defamation. For me, I do not see any credibility that this government has left that anyone we go through any stress to tarnish. You know, on the other side, on the other end, there's no law that prohibits anybody from wearing Buhari Must Go t-shirt, you know, to anywhere for that matter.
Deji, there appears to be confusion about the circumstances that led to the arrest of these five men. What really transpired from your perspective?
Yes, initially we were told, you know, and I saw this on social media in several news reports, that it was the church that arrested the five Buhari Must Go T-shirt protesters at the church and subsequently handed them over to the DSS. You know, but myself and Omoye Eleshowore, my brother, we went to see the head of the church, which is Pastor Paul Leneche. And we spoke with him for over 2 hours, and he briefed us on what happened. That he did not have a hand in it, the church did not have a hand in it, that the Buhari Must Go protesters, they had come to church, they had finished church, they had even come out for altar call. He was happy, you know, and that they gave their life to Christ and all that, and that they finished, that he was going on with the second and third service. He never knew what happened, you know, and it was after he had finished the second and third service, almost 3 hours later, that he was informed that the DSS had arrested the protesters at the entrance of the church, where they were broadcasting live and having a protest after service, you know. And basically, one thing that is clear from our meeting with him is that he swore that both him and the church had spoken against human rights violations in the country, had been on the side of the people who have criticized, you know, human rights violations. That wouldn't it be a paradox of some sort if the church that has constantly criticized human rights violations now engages in same? And if you see the statement from the church, it is clear. That being said, I believe that the DSS, you know, who have been in the habit of criminalizing the DSS, the police, even when we came out from the meeting, we're also harassed by the DSS and the police right in front of the church.
I understand a group has filed a petition in court against the DSS in support of the detained protesters. Does your group support the move with the legal challenge of their continued detention?
We support this legal action 100% because the DSS, they have no locus. Protest is not a crime. I personally, you know, do not see why a democratically elected government should criminalize protest. There's no known law that says that protest is criminalized in this country. There's also no law that prohibits people from wearing certain T-shirts in the country. So we support this group that is filing for the fundamental enforcement, you know, for the rights of those who have been unlawfully detained by the DSS. The DSS has no locus in this matter. And that's why we support those who have filed the action.
Deji Adeyanju is the convener for Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. In Cameroon, women peace activists plan to meet at a 3-day national convention to discuss solutions to the ongoing conflict in the Central African country. The conference, which is organized by the Cameroon Women's Peace Movement, is scheduled from July 29 to 31 in the capital, Yaoundé. Human rights groups say ongoing violence between Anglophone rebels and the military has left over 3,000 people dead and over 1 million displaced from their homes. Organizers say the meeting will bring together over 1,000 women leaders from the 10 regions of the country. It will be the first Women's National Peace Convention aimed at finding ways to resolve the country's conflict. Women's groups say the ongoing killing of unarmed civilians, including women and children, is unacceptable. Local media reports that both sides of the conflict have so far refused to accept a ceasefire and dialogue as part of an effort to end the violence. For more on the upcoming peace convention, I reached Yvonne B. Muma, co-founder of Cameroon Women's Peace Movement.
Women are coming together in Yaoundé from all the 58 divisions of Cameroon because it's not only those who are in the conflict areas who are affected, but it has rippled down to all the other areas where there is no conflict for now. And following UN Security Council Resolution 1325, where there is no conflict, they will be learning about prevention and will be armed with tools of early warning signs. So women are coming from all over Cameroon to add their voice to the peace building process that is ongoing. Our motto is leave no one behind, all women on deck to add their voices to the peace process.
So Yvonne, what are the key areas that you will be looking at or participants will be addressing?
The first issue we'll be looking at is the participation of women in peace-building processes. You know that in times of conflict, women are disproportionately affected. But when it comes to negotiations, like what has obtained in Cameroon, the women's voices have been listened or have not been heard in their majority. So what are the key issues? Women think that adding their voices to call for a ceasefire, for an end to hostilities, and that there should be a continuum of dialogue is of essence. Women, it's not like they've not been doing anything. They've worked in dispersed ranks. But this time we want to re-echo our voices from all the angles of Cameroon, talking like one person, bringing out womanhood. Because every child or soldier that dies is like a sword that is sent across the heart of a woman.
Well, Ms. B, what is going to be different now? Because several NGOs, civil society groups have called on both parties to end this ongoing conflict, which has adversely affected women and children caught in the crossfire. What is specifically going to be different this time from this convention?
Yes, several NGOs have called, but in dispersed ranks. Several women's groups have come out. They've lamented, they've cried, they've done all, but in dispersed ranks. This time, Peter, I want to tell you, women shall be assembling from the 10 regions of Cameroon. It's a critical mass. Women are a majority of the population, and the powers that be have us interest to listen to the women's voices. I think women can change the narrative. We believe in our strength, we believe in our unity, and we believe that every man who wields a gun out there belongs to a woman, either like mother, like wife, like sister, like cousin. They have a relationship with women. And all these men go back to women, so women can talk them out of this violence. Women can talk them into dropping their guns and sitting on the table.
So, B, what do you say to those who are of the opinion and are skeptical that this coming together of women groups to demand for dialogue to end this ongoing violence will not yield any fruit, because they contend that because the government has described the separatists as terrorist groups, it is unlikely for officials of the government to sit down with these separatists, or so to speak, the Amber Boys, to negotiate to end this conflict and to return the country to peace?
It's their opinion and they have a right to it. But we believe that dialogue does not hold only between friends. At a dialogue table, we expect people who claim to be enemies to sit and discuss. Our government, if they have been thinking that these people are terrorists, they cannot talk with them, today the women of Cameroon will remind them that those are our sons, those are our husbands, those are our brothers. If they picked the gun, they had reasons. And the gun cannot solve the problem. We think sitting at a table is indispensable for them to discuss the issues of Cameroon, for them to discuss a way out of this. The burden of this, the ongoing crisis all over Cameroon, is too much on women, and women as a majority of the population shall be mobilized to take up their responsibilities and remind the powers that be that enough is enough.
Yvonne B. Muma is the co-founder of Cameroon Women's Peace Movement, a civil society group. She spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. Zambia, the Foundation for Democratic Process, or FODEP, a civil society group, is calling on the governing Patriotic Front and the main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND Alliance, to ensure that their supporters follow guidelines meant to stop the spread of the coronavirus. The group is also calling on followers to refrain from politically related violence in the run-up to the August 12 general election. This, as the Electoral Commission of Zambia reviews plans to lift a ban it imposed on the two leading political parties. Citing politically related violence, the electoral body imposed a ban on any campaigning by the PF and the UPND Alliance in the capital, Lusaka, and two other parts of the country. FODEP says it welcomes plans by the Electoral Commission to lift the ban. It, however, says the commission must hold accountable supporters of any party who engage in violence during the election period. For more reaction about the plans by the electoral body to lift the ban on campaigning in the capital, Lusaka, I reached George Chimembe, Executive Director for the Foundation for Democratic Process, or FODEP.
Yeah, our position is that ECZ should go ahead to lift the suspension of these two political parties so that they go back into their campaign activities. We believe that in the period that they have been suspended, they have reflected on their activities, and they have spoken to their cadres to refrain from engaging in violence.
What about the issue of observing the COVID-19 protocols? Because some Zambians have expressed concern that these political parties are going about holding rallies, even door-to-door campaigns, which they see as super spreaders of the COVID-19 disease in Zambia.
The problem has been, again, that authorities have allowed the ruling patriotic front to go ahead and restrained from conducting their campaign activities without observing the COVID 19 guidelines that have been given by the health authorities. For instance, yesterday the president toured one of the markets in the compounds, and that was a super spreader. But on the other hand, if the opposition parties go out to do similar things, then they are restrained by the authorities. We think that this is unfair application of these measures, and it should come to a stop.
There are concerns that political tensions will significantly increase in weeks to come ahead of the elections. Some of your organizations, including religious groups, civil society groups, are calling on supporters of the political parties not to engage in violence. But there is real fear that the violence could increase ahead of the elections. What is your take on that?
Well, the onus is really on the ECZ to deal with the situation firmly by invoking the provisions of the Electoral Code of Conduct, including going to the extent of not only suspending these campaign activities, but also disqualifying candidates where electoral violence will happen so that we have a peaceful election come August 12th.
Well, George, some UPND supporters are on record to have accused the police of being biased in favor of the ruling party, and that in some cases supporters have been prevented from campaigning and all that. Are their criticisms justified? And how do you think the police can rectify this to show independence, as some people say they want to see in the run-up to the elections?
Yes, Peter, this is very much justified because most of the time we have seen Zambia police shielding perpetrators of violence from the PF. You see, it all boils down to the issue of application of the law, during this time. And we see that the police have been unfairly applying the Public Order Act. But also, it appears that the Zambia police has been infiltrated by cadres, we actually pity the Zambia police because it's difficult for them to operate professionally and independently because of interference from the executive arm of government.
What is FODEP's message to the people of Zambia, as well as these two major political parties, as the suspension preventing them from campaigning in the capital, Lusaka, elapses this week?
Appealing to the Zambian people to go out there and exercise their democratic right to choose candidates of their choice. We are a peace-loving nation, and the world is watching us. What is at stake is not actually elections, but it is how we preserve our peaceful nation. Because after August 12th, we still will have our Zambia, but we don't want to have our Zambia which is in flames.
Joe Chimembe is the executive director for the Foundation for Democratic Process, FODE, a civil society group. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Meanwhile, the Resident Doctors Association of Zambia is calling on the international community to help provide aid, including personal protective equipment, to its members as the country battles a surge in coronavirus infections. Dr. Brian Sampa, president of the Doctors Group, says the organization will continue to partner with the government in the effort to limit the spread of the disease. His remarks come after reports that at least 100 doctors have tested positive for the disease in the recent surge. The Resident Doctors Association says it is deeply concerning that members of the group do not have the needed medical supplies to help treat COVID-19 patients. The group is calling on the government to ensure members are paid monies owed them and are provided improved working conditions. For more reaction about the call for international help in fighting the increase in coronavirus cases, I reached Dr. Brian Sampa, president of the Resident Doctors Association of Zambia.
As I speak, I was just coming from the hospital, and then I received a call from a colleague that he is having COVID, he is at home. I couldn't even go there because I don't have PPE. Now, the issue of PPE is a general need in Zambia. You find that in the hospitals, very few doctors, specifically those who are in the COVID wards, are the ones who are accessing PPEs. Even for them, it's not enough. So we need PPEs because that's one of the reasons why these doctors and other healthcare workers are having to contract this deadly virus. Then the other problem we had at first was oxygen, but people have come on board and it has been sorted. So the other issue now, which is with us, apart from the PPE, is that if the international community can come in and help, you know, with human resource. We've got a lot of doctors who are not yet employed, and we've got clinical officers, those who've done diploma in clinical medicine, who are willing to join the battle, but because the government does not have resources to employ these people. So if the international community can come on board and employ these people, and then also provide the necessary PPEs and medication.
Are you teaming up with the government to address some of these challenges you are talking about too?
Yes, actually what we've been doing is we've been advocating for people to come on board, and some people have already come on board. And once these donations are made, they are going direct to the hospitals. And, you know, we are just supplementing the efforts of the government. We do understand there are a lot of limitations in what the government is able to do at this point in time. They have employed about 340 doctors so far, but we have other doctors who are not yet employed. That's because the resources are not there. So with all this, what we need is more people on board. We appreciate what has been done so far, but we believe something should be done more if we are to fight this battle conclusively.
You talk about the government not having resources to employ the rest of the doctors who are there but have not been employed. Some people are expressing concern that that is the reason why the government cannot even afford to increase the payment of doctors in the country, for which reason some people are blaming the government over a stalemate it had with your organization, for which your license has been suspended because the allegation is that you are spearheading the doctors to withdraw services at a crucial time when most people need medical services to combat or limit the spread of this coronavirus. How do you address this concern?
Well, you know, to start with, our aim as an association and also as the doctors as a whole in Zambia is to ensure that we provide quality health services. Now, these quality health services requires doctors to be motivated, requires the things to use in the hospitals to be there. Because if you don't have what to use in the hospitals, then the doctors are at risk and the patients are also at risk. If doctors are not motivated, the patients are at risk because those doctors won't do their jobs diligently. So ours was just the mandate to communicate to the government what the membership wanted. And the members, after so many years of discussions with the government, they reached a stage where they felt they were not being appreciated, they were not being heard. Mind you, we already foresaw that things were going to be bad. We saw the third wave coming. We knew that with the shortages, we needed more doctors employed. If the government had listened then, we may have been in a better situation right now. Our intentions are to ensure that the patient ultimately gets the perfect health care. And for us to achieve that, we need doctors to be cared for, and we also need everything that is needed to be in the hospital to be available. That's what we have been fighting. Because how can a doctor work and not get paid? How do you expect that doctor to go for work and concentrate on work? These are people who are supposed to be absorbed by the system, and they are supposed to continue supplementing. Because one thing that I need to remind you also is that in Zambia, after the COVID-19 cases became too much, the government decided that the outpatient departments should be put on hold, meaning that the doctors are now concentrating on emergencies. So the other people who are sick but they are not emergencies, they have to wait. But one day, this is a time bomb, because these other people will still come back to the hospital as emergencies. So what is best is not to hold them for now, but to employ more healthcare workers so that these people can still continue going for those outpatient departments.
Dr. Brian Sampa is the president of the Resident Doctors Association of Zambia. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports, Douglas Impuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, Education International, a global group representing teachers around the world, is expressing concern about recent developments in the Kingdom of Eswatini. It condemns reports of the deployment of police and the military to crack down on recent protests that turned violent. It also called for more democratic freedoms to enable citizens to choose their own leaders. Sikelele Dlamini, the Secretary General of the Swaziland National Association of Teachers, or SNAT, says the group welcomes Education International's statements of support. He says the international community, including the Southern African Development Committee, or SADC, should pressure the authorities in Imbabani to allow a true democracy in Eswatini. But critics say SNAT appears to have sharply deviated from its core mission, which they say is to advocate for the well-being of teachers. They contend that leaders have supported pro-democracy groups who want to overthrow King Nswati III and his administration. Sikelele Dlamini tells me that the Eswatini Teachers Group is prepared to play a major role in the efforts by SADC to ease political tensions, engage all stakeholders, and help formulate a negotiated settlement to the crisis facing the kingdom.
As the leadership of the Swaziland National Association of Teachers, we welcome the statement that has been forwarded to us and to the government of Swaziland by Education International, because at this point in time, we are going through very, very difficult times as a country and as citizens because of the political turmoil that has engulfed the country. And I think the rest of Africa and probably many countries from many parts of the world are beginning to refocus on Swaziland because of the human rights abuses. So we welcome the statement by Education International. It gives us the moral support that we so much need and desire at this particular point in time.
Some Swazis are also expressing concern that the organization SNAD seem to have turned very political, and that you are behind and organizing some of these protests that have turned violent, leaving at least 52 people dead. 200 people, I understand, have been injured as a result of it.
As a teacher union, we know for a fact that we are a labor union, and our operational domain is that of a labor union. We do not engage actively on purely political issues, but as a human rights organization, we embrace international principles and concepts such as democracy. What we have done as an organization is that we have aligned ourselves with the rest of the organizations inside Swaziland that are calling for a democratic dispensation that will see each and every citizen participating actively in the running of his or her affairs. In fact, that is what we are all about as SNAT, but we are also mindful of the fact that as a union, we are concerned about the bread and butter issues and probably sexual and professional issues that affect our members. But the truth of the matter is we are only joining the call of those people who are calling for a democratic dispensation. It may not be necessarily be true that we are behind planning the countrywide protest. It's just that we were participating in the protest, although we will know for a fact that What then happened, it ended up being a riot more than just being an organized protest, but we understood it as educators to mean it is a way in which the sources are expressing their discontentment, their dissatisfaction, and their confusion about the status quo. That is why people were then doing things in ways that are not acceptable.
Is your organization going to engage with other stakeholders and the government to try to resolve this ongoing impasse?
Teachers are torchbearers in each and every society. That is why I loosely define teaching as a professional way of emancipating citizens of any country or society from the bondage of ignorance. And as such, we are promising that we are going to play an active role in the negotiated settlement. But we, of course, know that as the teacher union, we also affiliate to our labor center and the labor center that we affiliate to. If those who are going to be meeting the SADC Troika organ on peace and security are going to request for representatives from labor, we will welcome an arrangement where we are going to be represented by those who are serving in the labor center. It may not necessarily be us directly participating, but of course, you know that through representative democracy and through the delegation of authority kind of setup, we can be able to participate, but actually giving those who are going to be representing us in those forums, so they are going to be carrying our mandate as well.
What is your reaction to supporters of the government who are of the view that leaders of SNAD, including yourself, who have been participating in the protests that have turned violent, should be arrested and prosecuted for threatening the country's peace and stability?
The powers that be are well aware of our duties and our obligations as the teacher union. But again, it is true that those members of parliament who were at the forefront of everything, they are warrants of arrest already prepared, and they are going to be arrested. But we haven't heard anything with regards to the teachers, including myself and the president. Our role is clear. And if I can tell you, we were not actually taking an active role, but what we were only doing was actually to offer solidarity, moral support, and sort of give explanations and directions where needed, because we are part of the society as well.
Sikilele Dlamini is the Secretary General of the Swaziland National Association of Teachers, or SNAD. He spoke with me from the Eswatini capital, Mbabane. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. At the Tokyo Olympics, spectators are largely barred as the government declared a COVID emergency. The games in Japan will be held without spectators at venues in and around the capital after a spike in coronavirus infections. Olympic Minister Tamayo Marukawa made the announcement after talks with officials and organizers on Thursday. Venues in Tokyo and other areas near the capital will not be allowed to hold events with fans during the games. But stadiums in the regions of Fukushima, Miyagi, and Shizuoka will be permitted to have spectators up 50% of capacity and up to 10,000 people. The Olympic Games are scheduled to take place in the Japanese capital between July 23rd and August 8th. The Paralympic Games are between August 24th and September 5th. In football, the African Cup of Nations will take place as planned in Cameroon in January 2022, according to CAF Secretary General Mosenga Omba. Omba also dismissed rumors that said Cameroon could once more be stripped of hosting the continent's biggest sporting competition by CAF, as it was the case in 2019. The Africa Cup of Nations will begin on January 9th and conclude on February 6th, with the final in the capital city, Yaounde. Meanwhile, Moroccan club Raja Casablanca survived a second-half battering from Algerian rivals JS Kabylie with 10 men to win the CAF Confederation Cup final 2-1 in Benin's commercial capital, Cotonou, on Saturday. It was Raja's second Confederation Cup triumph in 4 seasons and 8 overall in CAF competitions, confirming them as the 5th most successful club. Raja have won the Champions League 3 times, the Confederation Cup and Super Cup 2 times each, and the now defunct CAF Cup once. Apart from the $1.25 million first prize, Raja will face the CAF Champions League winners for the Cup Super Cup on a date to be announced. Turning to athletics, in Monaco, world champion Timothy Chiroyot won the men's 1500 meters in a world-leading 3 minutes 28.28 seconds after struggling at Kenya's Olympic team trials in June. There are also world-leading displays from 2012 Olympic silver medalist Nigel Amos, who won the men's 800 meters in 1 minute 42.91 seconds. Ethiopia's Lamecha Gima, who clinched the men's 3,000 meters steeplechase in 8 minutes, 7.75 seconds, and Olympic champion Faith Kipyegon, who prevailed in the women's 1,500 meters in 3 minutes, 54.07 seconds. And South African sprinter Akani Simbene and Burkinabe triple jumper Fabrice Lango both continued their preparations for the Tokyo Olympics by setting new Africa records in Hungary on Tuesday. Simbine's 100 meters time of 9.84 seconds eclipsed the time of 9.85 seconds set by Nigeria's Olusoji Fasuba in Qatar in 2006. The South Africa's time is the second fastest of the year, behind the American Trayvon Bromell's 9.77 seconds. Zongo broke his own African triple jump record for the fourth time with a leap of 17.82 meters, which was 15 centimeters further than the mark he set in June. However, he came second to Portugal's Pedro Pichado, who jumped 17.92 meters. There was also an Algerian record for Yasser Mohamed Triki at 17.33 as he finished third. Sprinters Marie-Jose Talou of Ivory Coast and Nigeria's Blessings Okabare both set their personal season's best of 100 meters, but could only finish third and fourth respectively. Ethiopian athletes dominated the men's 3,000 meters as they claimed the top 5 places in the race, which was won by 2-time world 5,000 meters champion Edris Mokhtar. Finally, Formula E will race in South Africa next season as part of its 16-race calendar. The event in Cape Town on February 26, 2022 will be the country's first top-level single-seater race since Formula One's South Africa GP in 1993. Next year's calendar also includes races in Mexico and China before ending in Seoul, South Korea in August. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. As of last week, former President of South Africa, Jacob Zuma, was confined in a South African prison cell somewhere in South Africa. The saga of President Zuma in South Africa has been long and sometimes exhausting. It would appear that his confinement to prison now meant that his many opponents within the African National Congress, ANC, and the opposition in parliament, as well as the commercial community in South Africa, have finally obtained the pound of flesh. Some would say that with the dribble of stain of blood seen everywhere. The issue that stuck against President Zuma came after he became president. Previous efforts were made to frustrate his climb towards the presidency. These failed. And when he became president, the opposition continued. But the question of state capture and the Gupta brothers became too difficult to overcome. And after he left the presidency, The investigation about corruption continues, and former President Zuma refused to participate in the investigation on the grounds that those who are trying to investigate him were biased and already made up their mind against him. And therefore, he said he would not participate and said at the time that he would prepare to pay the price for not cooperating with the investigation. And that price came in the form of a decision by the Constitutional Court, which found that former President Zuma had been guilty of contempt of courts and sentenced him to 15 months of prison. This was very significant because it demonstrated what many of his opponents want to demonstrate, that no man or no person in South Africa is above the law. And they therefore joyously hailed the sentence of Zuma as a triumph of the rule of law. But make no mistake, the day may come when those who are hailing the principles of the rule of law may rue the day they hailed this principle, because they could not say whether they themselves may be one day called upon to obey that principle. But what had bothered South Africa in the past few weeks was whether Zuma would or would not comply with the prison sentence. There were fears everywhere. There was a camp around the president. Even within his family, there was a division. His son said that over their dead body would he be arrested and taken to prison. But his daughter, reminding them that the former president has said he would go to prison without fear, predicted that the president would courageously and quietly go to prison. And it turned out that she was correct. So while there was talk of Zuma appealing to the High Court, the judgment of the Constitutional Court was a report that he already had surrendered to the prison officials and was already in prison. There was, of course, attempt by everyone to stress that former President Zuma will be subjected to the same terms as every single South African, that no special arrangements will be made for him, except in terms of security, because right now he is entitled to security details and therefore he may be confined to a secure cell in prison. It also turned out that there have been intense negotiations to prevent any kind of violence involving the judiciary, the ANC, and the government, and they are all now agreed on the conditions under which former President Zuma will be detained in prison. First, that he will wear, of course, the prison garb as every South African, that he would be quarantined for the first 2 weeks instead of COVID-19, but that on good behavior, he might serve only for 4 of the 15 months. And this seems to have calmed down fears, and it seems there's agreement all around that this is a fair arrangement. So the next stage of the Zuma saga is this. Will there be a new drama in this saga? One thing is very clear. The confinement of Zuma in prison has done tremendous harm to the ANC. It will deepen the division within the ANC, and it's going to have serious repercussion in the electoral fortunes of the ANC in the next elections. The question then is, what next? After Zuma has served his sentence, will he still resist appearing before the investigating committee? This will be a very difficult issue, not only for Zuma, but for the South African people. What then? No one knows. We may well be at a slippery slope of South African ANC politics, and we will have to see. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Hivi ungewezaje kuishi bila unayempenda, ama ingetokeaje yote dunia kukutenda? Wanavyojua mimi mapenzi ya mwisho matamu, hasa ukishapenda mwenzi akakuchenga. Hisia na mwili ukipata maradhi, ukizinga kukimbiwa, kabeba silaha jambazi. Kuna muda una enjoy matamu, kuna muda unalia machungu. Utayasifia matamu, kesho yataki tena machungu. Tata tatizo mapenzi, kama mlevi kisa mapenzi, afilisika eti mapenzi, wanagombana kisa mapenzi. Kadata tatizo mapenzi, kawa mlevi kisa mapenzi, kafilisika eti mapenzi, wanagombana kisa mapenzi. Mchezo gani uo mwisho wa kumbuku yuema? Hata utende mazuri bule, tamukisha mjini shule. Saita kwaje na itakwaje, shakuwa teja na uwezi. Kidole ushapingana, paka mapepe unaibiwa. Zina utumwa hisia, na mwili ukipata maradhi, ukizinga kukimbiwa, kabeba silaha jambazi. Kuna muda una enjoy matamu, kuna muda unalia machungu. Utayasifia matamu, kesho yataki tena machungu. Kadata tatizo mapenzi, kawa mlevi kisa mapenzi, afilisika eti mapenzi, wanagombana kisa mapenzi. Kadata tatizo mapenzi, kawa mlevi kisa mapenzi, afilisika eti mapenzi, wanagombana kisa mapenzi.
Foreign affairs, that is my department. You get to meet me only by husband. People didn't really understand my husband. I'm so janded, look at all my garment. Excuse me, what is all this embarrassment? Why will you give me pounded yam? It's for us, man. Are you guys not having lasagne? Then I can wash it down with champagne. What of shiny strides or pizzas? I don't do mainland, only fee high. I'm the man that the babes want to cash early. It's because I base in Los Angeles. Shuma Cameron, me and brother David. He's a close friend, I used to drive his helicopter. In your whole life, you don't get to see my brother. Billionaire boy, to buy family, you take dollar.
I'm foreign,
I'm so jaded.
I'm foreign,
I'm from abroad.
I'm foreign, just call me foreign, baby, oh.
International.
Foreign, baby, just call me foreign, baby, oh.
I'm international.
Foreign,
international.
Foreign, baby, just call me foreign, baby.
I'm
International.
I got to fly into London town today. On the way, maybe I will just branch UK and get back before you get that. But I can't go because of just like.
I need your breakfast with a nice rising nigga. Phone call with Queen Eliza. I know too like you with her. So I travel for this end.
It's not my stuff, no need for sent for. I travel so much, I'm building a airport. Because I'm mixed race with a little spring blood. That's why you people discriminate against us.
You know me, I don't believe.
So chanted. I'm from abroad.
I'm foreign, just calling foreign, baby. Oh.
International.
Foreign, baby, just calling foreign, baby. Oh.
I'm international.
Foreign, baby, just calling foreign, baby. Oh.
International.
Foreign.
Was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Bill Eagle, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a pad that breaks a pot of water does not remain on the head. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.